Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, Kathy Sorrells is speaking on engaging in creative process, mystery. So let's listen in on Kathy.
We began to look at it in terms of the beginning stages of preparation and then moving into mystery, the mysterious time when it's a part of letting go, not knowing, moving into the unknown, trying to get rid of our preconceived notions about whatever it is that we're working on, letting go of things. Then the potential is there to move into inspiration. And then if you go around the cycle, you actually do the creation, you make it real. So you take the inspiration and you make it real, you create something. And through that process, then you come to assessment, you assess what you've done. And what we're trying to do this week is to move through this process. So yesterday we were focusing on preparation, today a bit more on mystery, and then we'll move through the cycle. As I said several times before, it's a kind of compacted amount of time to move through the cycle, but we're working on it. So, but Grace mentioned a quote, and I wrote it up here. And do you want to say it?
The harder you hold on, the more the rope burns.
Yes,
that's Viktor Frankl.
By Viktor Frankl, the harder you hold on, the more the rope burns. Which is true, if you've ever climbed out a rope. And another one that I wanted to add today is by Henry Miller. Would you like to say some more about that?
I was making a comment. It depends on whether you're getting your hands burned or your legs broken.
Well, that's true. Now, that's a good point there. You might not want to let go entirely.
It depends on how low you
are. Right.
Seppi didn't mean this literally.
It's sort of like the poem yesterday. The poem. But another one by Henry Miller, which is, until we accept the fact that life is founded in mystery, we shall learn nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's about accepting the part of life which is about mystery, which is about the unknown and letting it unfold. So we're going to do a bit of that. I wanted to ask before, as we move into it, if there were any other reflections or comments from yesterday that anyone wanted to add.
Well, I said this to you, but I was, you know, the first question that we were to discuss among ourselves was a person that we knew personally that was very creative, and I didn't think of until I went home and back to my room and thought for a while that the most creative person I know personally is my father, but he did this all in the context of his everyday life. He lost one of his hands when he was sort of in midlife. But he continued to do everything, and apparently without any greater effort. Of course, this happened before I was born. He had worked into it before by the time. But we, the family, never considered him handicapped. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he had to have been extremely creative to have accomplished this.
What was she doing back in her room?
Actually, because I think in the whole ministry process, one of the biggest things you have to do is hold on to your sense of humor, because it can get very heavy and dark. So thank you for that, both of you. Louise, I was just teasing. You don't get to use your
voice. Well, I understood the story bit, but none of us are vacuuming our rooms.
That's a good thing. You have housekeeping to do that for you.
Oh, dear.
So,
she's a hard worker, Louise.
I wanted to start and tell you just briefly about something that has actually had a great deal of influence on me, and that is a woman named Angeles Arian, and she's a cross-cultural anthropologist. And she's studied indigenous cultures all over the world, and she's spent time with them. She's actually Basque herself, which is from the region in Spain that's close to France, the Basque area. And she came to this country I think in her 20s with her father and her family, and lived in Idaho, and they would live there for 3 years, and then they would go back to the old country, to the Basque land, and spend a couple years there. And then the father was the culture carrier, and he would bring the culture back here, and they would go back and forth. And through that experience, I think she realized the value of the traditional culture, but also the value of contemporary culture and how to integrate those. So she spent her life studying indigenous cultures and trying to figure out, well, what do indigenous cultures have to offer to the contemporary world? And one thing that I'm very fond of is what she calls the fourfold way. And it's essentially what she's saying is that indigenous peoples believe that if you do these four things, everything else will be taken care of. And the first one is to show up. Which always gets you to laugh, but what it really means is to not just be here physically, but to be fully here, to be present, to be right here. And that does take some letting go of everything else, but to be present, to show up, is the first one. And the second one is to pay attention to what has heart and meaning. Okay. Pay attention to what has heart and meaning. I'll write them up on the board later.
Could you write your name also?
Yeah. She works out of Berkeley. So the second one is to pay attention to what has heart and meaning. To notice, in a way, it's to say, I'm noticing what inspires me, what's meaningful to me. The third one is to speak your truth without blame or judgment. And I think you can take that more broadly than just speaking, but it's to be in the world without blame or judgment. So it's not just speaking, but when you act, when you talk with other people, when you listen to other people, try to do that without blame or judgment. Which sounds a little bit familiar to our character, the woodcarver, yesterday, about blame and judgment. And actually, she says that the traditions say that if you do all three of those, you don't have to worry about the fourth one. It takes care of itself. But the fourth one is actually the one that I'm most interested in for us today. And that is to be open to outcome and not attached to outcome. So it's about letting go of praise and criticism, letting go of other people's values, of what they think about what you're doing, letting go of what you expect it to be, and letting what is be there.
That's what I'm having problems with.
Yeah, that's what we all have problems with. It's the fourth one.
Open to outcome.
Not attached to outcome.
Not attached.
Right. So be open to possibilities. Instead of, I'm going to do this and this is going to happen afterwards. Or this, I'm coming to this class and this is what this class is about. But to be open to the possibilities that come.
Isn't this that whole philosophy of being just the opposite of what young people are told now, and that is to plan their lives and to have a goal. And if you don't have a goal, you will not achieve anything. This is a whole different approach.
It is a different approach, and I think it's important. It is I think it's a complementary approach. And I think that that Angela's, in response to that, just because we're talking about her, would say that one doesn't invalidate the other. and it doesn't mean that this philosophy is the right one. Again, it's not the right one, and the philosophy that's Western or that's current is the wrong one, but how can we actually hold both of them? And I think what she would say also about, maybe I should speak for myself, what I would say is that you have goals and intentions, and you hold those as visions and a purpose, but you can't be too attached to them. So how do you do both of those things? I mean, because it's not a matter of just being here in the moment all the time. I mean, I'm not talking about 1960s flower children kind of just be with whatever is. There is a sense of attention and a sense of goals, but you let go of that as you move into things.
You're talking about faith.
Yeah, thank you. That's another word for it. That's another word for it. And grace. Yeah. So we're going to practice a little bit of this. The folks yesterday got a sense of the experiential style that I have, and we're going to continue with that today. What I want to do, what we're going to all do, is I'm going to give you some clay. And we're going to go through sort of a meditative process, and then we're going to create a pot, a pinch pot. A pinch pot. So you're going to pinch it. You're going to use your hands. A pinch. What do you think I said? And actually, after the last bis firing here, I threw some, literally. I decided I didn't want to keep them, and I just went outside. But what we're going to do is we're going to work with some clay. And so what I'm really trying to do is to practice the things that we've been talking about, to practice the notion of letting go, of caring what it looks like when it's done, to focus more on the process here. We're not concerned about the beauty of the pot. We're concerned about you being present and showing up with the clay. Okay? So, any questions?
What we achieve is going to be a mystery.
That's what you do. Yeah, what we achieve is going to be a mystery. Yeah. If anybody wants a towel, Bobby will give you a towel. What we're going to do is you're going to just want to sort of slip away from the table, because I don't want you to set this on the table, and you're going to sit like this and with your ball of clay, and then we're going to work with it in our hands. So if you'd like to put a towel over your pants or your...
It's a big one.
So you want to just hold it in your hands like...
Nice and cold.
It's been downstairs in the... Which is not heated. So these are called pinch pots, is what we're going to do.
Speak up.
Here
you
go.
Okay,
does everybody have clay? So if you don't start yet, just hold it as a round ball, if you don't mind. And what I am going to ask you to do is to close your eyes and to keep them closed during this process. So if you want to just hold the clay in your hands and take it, and you're going to just try and form it a little bit into a ball. Just feel the clay, feel the coolness of the clay. What you want is kind of an orange shape. So again, the pot that we're going to create here is not so important as the practice, the act of practicing, and letting go of criticism and judgment, and whether you're going to be praised for this pot or not praised for this pot. So if you'll just let your hands rest in your lap and put your feet on the floor and sit up straight, comfortably, and take a couple deep breaths. Relax your shoulders. Make sure you're not holding your stomach in too tightly. Nobody's watching, everybody's got their eyes closed. And just bring your awareness into how you're feeling right now. And it's okay if you're feeling that you think this is really stupid. Just let go of that. Let it come in and let it go out. And try and see if you can bring your awareness and your attention to your feet and feel your feet on the ground. And then bring your attention up to your ankles. See if you can put your attention into your ankles. Remember to keep breathing. And let your attention slowly move up your leg into your calves and then into your knees. Then on up your leg onto your thighs. Maybe you can feel the weight of your hands pressed against your thighs with the ball of clay in it. And see if you can move your attention to your backbone and come up your spine. If you can feel the muscles around your spine. Just breathe gently. And then bring your attention on up into your neck. In your throat. See if you can relax all the muscles in your face. Just let your face relax. Let go of all the tension in your face. Come back to your torso and see if you can feel yourself breathing. Pay attention to your breath. Taking in a breath, holding it for a second or two, and then letting it go. Taking another breath and let it go. let your attention come down through your arms. And feel that you're holding this ball of clay. See, how does it feel on your fingers? Keep breathing gently. And you want to take your two thumbs and put them at the top of the ball. And let them sit there for just a second. Then begin to apply some pressure. Just feel your thumbs moving down into the clay, beginning the opening for this pot. Push down until you feel some resistance, and then pull your thumbs out and turn the ball of clay slightly in one direction or the other, and put your thumbs back into that hole. And push down again. So what you'll do is you'll keep slowly rotating the ball of clay and pushing your thumbs down in to form the center of the pot. Work slowly with your rhythm of your breathing. And you want to work down until you're about a half inch from the bottom. So you're still just slowly rotating it and pushing your thumbs down into the bottom to form the bottom. So whenever you'd like, you can put the pot more into one hand and use the other with your thumb in the center and your two fingers on the outside, and begin to bring your fingers and thumbs together in a pinching motion.
I'm not able to hear you.
Okay. Thank you. You want to have your thumb in the center and your two fingers on the outside, and then hold the pot in the other hand, and as you pinch it, rotate it. Pull your thumb and your fingers together and pinch, and then rotate it. Your thumb and fingers together and then rotate it.
Just want to continue doing that rotation.
Just continue rotating, and at some point when you feel you've gotten your pot to the right thickness, the walls are the thickness that you want, you can do another technique, which is called stroking. And you'll want to start again with your thumb in the middle and your fingers on the outside, and essentially pull up, stroke upwards. This is to even out the walls. Again, you'll rotate. You'll stroke in one place, and then rotate. Stroke in the next place, and then rotate. This is to get a little more evenness on your pot. pay attention to your pot as the wood carver paid attention to the tree. Let the pot and the clay speak to you. So this is a dialogue, not just what you want, but also what the clay wants. See if you can pay attention to that. If you'd like, you can also put your fingers on the inside and your thumb on the outside, if you'd like to switch it around, and stroke that way.
I don't have a pot.
Experience your clay through your eyes. That is a pot.
You're too honest, Louise.
Sure, if you'd like. The question was also, can you work on it with your eyes open? You're welcome to do anything you would like with your pot as we go along. And if it's not a pot, you can do anything you'd like with your clay. And I've had people before that never did even open the pot. It was still a ball of clay. That's what spoke to them or didn't. So it's perfectly wonderful, whatever it is that came about through this experience. What I would like you to do, though, is, and if you don't have pencil and paper, we can, does everybody have a pencil and paper? We can find you. I'd like you to take about 5 minutes and just write down what this experience was like for you. If you feel you need to go wash your hands first, that's fine. We are going to take a break right after we do the writing.
Where do you want us to put our pots?
You may put them in front of you. You may put them on the floor. Yeah, that's fine to put them on the table. I will wash the table up.
You want us to put them on the towel?
Yeah, so if you take about 5 minutes and just, it doesn't have to be complete sentences, nobody's going to read this, and don't worry about spelling. Just write down what the experience was like for you, something that whatever came to you, how it felt, what you learned, what it was like. If you need something, Tony, did you need something to write?
No.
Do you want to pick up the paper?
Nope. This is just for you. Absolutely just for you.
Kathy, may I say something to you, please?
Sure.
As you were guiding us through this whole procedure, I felt that you neglected to say what to do with the center part sticking up, because if one took the ball and began doing, as you said, from the first step, I had a central part sticking up, which would not make a bowl. Therefore, I depressed it. on my own. Well, you didn't say to do it.
The clay was telling you that. The clay was telling you that.
And Louise, I had the same experience, so I just turned it over.
Well, I mean, if you do, as you were saying, thumb here, fingers here, pinch, go around, you have an object sticking up in the center. And I was waiting for you to say at some point to depress that.
Well, what I would just say is that I know in communication, things can be heard and received in different ways, and also with clay, many things can happen. The way that I was talking about doing is like this.
All right, I guess I...
And then pushing down and then turning.
Okay.
Like that. And they're right. Often I have worked with people when I'm doing a clay workshop, they've done this with their eyes open, they've watched me do it.
Oh, I much prefer it.
And then we do it with our eyes closed, so you have a sense of it. But I wanted you all to experience it just like you did it, because you heard it differently. And then you did something different with it. And that's the beauty of it. Just like whoever it was that did the different things with it. Were you the one that did the things with the tomato?
Yeah.
So I think it's fun, and it's helpful to hear that the instructions might not have been as clear to you. And I think
but
that's
everybody
part
else
of
ended up with a whole wine or something.
But Louise, I turned mine over.
Yeah.
So remember, it's not about being attached to the outcome. It's being open to the outcome and the beauty of the outcome, and that's one thing I want each of you to take a little few minutes looking at your pot and just seeing the beauty in your pot.
Louise, far more interesting than
that. That's more amazing.
Look at how complimentary we were.
You make a puppet sauce.
Potted before. That looks professional.
I can just say,
he knows when he's potted before.
Without blame or judgment. We talked a minute ago about speaking the truth without blame or judgment, but it's also about seeing without blame or judgment. That it, and what she was saying was the beauty of the individuality of each person's pot. And the wonder of the fact that they're so different. That all of you listened to me, and again, like I said, I was fairly vague. I was not real specific. I didn't draw you a picture ahead of time. But look at the incredible diversity that came out of what was instructed.
That's right. Yeah. I was going to say, blame and judgment were more often like to blame and judge yourself. I can learn that quite as good as you're
about. Right. And that's true. And that's the whole, I mean, if there's one Christian lesson that I intend to try to remember it, and ask there are many, but it's to love yourself. And then you can love others. And again, not judging yourself so that you can not judge others. Your pot's okay. You're okay. I'm okay. Your pot's okay. Okay. Got it.
Is clay good on your hands? Mine are so soft with clay.
Well, it feels soft, and if you did left it on there all day, they would feel really dry. That's what happens is when you work with clay a lot, if you don't lotion a lot, you get really dry.
I don't know if people have taken yoga, but I felt I have, and I went back. You were relaxing us exactly like we did in yoga, and then you had the extra experience of the feel of the clay, the texture, the form, the development as we were going through it.
I actually do yoga. I also got part of this exercise from a man who is a pottery teacher who began to study meditation and yoga and put the two together. So
what I related this to was the similarities between working with clay and Brendo. And in Brendo you have the added mystery of yeast, what it's going to do to it. But as I worked on and on, I began to become
conscious of properties in clay that I hadn't
thought of.
Yeah.
And I think you do that when you work with your eyes closed. In some ways, you feel things differently. Another really exciting thing as we go through, if you all would like me to fire your pot, I will do that. It's just firing. If not, that's fine. But the other thing that's wonderful about clay work is that you can keep it as it is. If you put it out, probably in your room is best instead of right out in the sun. Don't want it to dry too fast. Just leave it in your room, it'll dry. And it won't hold water as is, unless it's got glaze on it. But a part of the whole pottery and ceramic process is the firing. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other layer of mystery. You don't know what is going to happen when you put this pot into fire.
Sort of like light.
It's a wonderful metaphor for personal transformation and personal change. Is that you really have to let go.
None of us wants fire, but that's going to make.
But that's what changes us, and that's what changes us.
Are you saying you will fire?
I will fire your pot.
Oh, I can
fire your pot. Yeah. And what I'll do is I'll bring a board up here and put it on like this. I'll put it back there. If you'd like it fired, we'll just put it there, and I'll put it down in the shop, and we'll fire them on Thursday.
So we get to sign them before you?
Yes, you can do that now, or you can do them at the leather hard stage,
which
will probably be about midnight tonight. actually, if you came back this afternoon, it would be better to sign it then. Or right now, you can pick it up and sign it either way.
No, I'll wait.
Or you can put it on the inside or on the side. Another thing you might want to do that I've done before is in your writing there, a certain word might have come up that was sort of central to your experience. You might want to write that word on the pot. Mm. It's really up to you.
I have a question about the technique. On the top, I notice it's uneven and jagged.
Right.
And I can just smear over the top of that.
Right.
And on the outside, it looks smooth. Now, but I know underneath it's not because the clay's not stuck together. When you fire it, will it fuse that clay?
Well, the best thing, if we were really working on this to make really good pinch pots, we would have, in that process, at some point I would have said to you, is to take your finger like this and really push down the top of it as you go along, because it gets thin at the top and begins to crack.
Yes.
And you don't want that. You want it pressed down, like you're saying. And If you want to go ahead and do that, that's fine.
Well, okay, but the cracks are in there, and pushing it down, I think at this point, is not going to.
The other option, and I can bring in, is this is going to sound kind of wild, but you can cut it with a pair of scissors. And you can just hold the scissors stationary and move the pot. So that if you want a consistent line across here, if you want to cut it up and down, you can do that. But yes, you can cut the top off.
But it won't, when you fire it, it doesn't take care of the clay.
Maybe it'll come out cracked is all it'll do. It won't like explode or anything dramatic, but.
But it will show on the glazed pot, will show the imperfections.
These pots probably won't get glazed, but if it were glazed, the glaze could often fill it. But as a pot that's unglazed, it would not.
You see, Cookie and I make different kinds
of pies. Yeah, I like to make pies.
Different kinds of pies. I want to ask if anything else came up for you in your writing or thoughts right now that relate this to the creative process, relate this to the things that we've been talking about.
The mystery of not knowing what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm. With your eyes closed.
The responsiveness of the clay. Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I like working with clay in this group, in this class, or this kind of class, is the responsiveness. That you get a sense you are the creator, but you are working with this clay body. That it's a dialogue. It's between the two of you. It's not just you working on it. It is a dialogue between you and the clay. Mm-hmm.
It was helpful to do it without your eyes open, because I would have started judging it right away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The fragility of it.
Really? Yeah. And it's more about your sense of touch, too, because I was assessing this as I went along. I had an intention of hoping it would come out somewhat
as opposed to your eyes. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Whenever we stop using one of our senses, the other ones become more activated. Mm-hmm. Is it Liz?
Yes.
Yeah, I think your comment. Could you say that again?
because I couldn't look at what I was doing, I didn't have to judge it. Although when I did open my eyes, then I started wanting to.
Right. And I think that's just something to remember also as a metaphor in our lives, is how can we suspend that judgment? I mean, we can't close our eyes and walk around and do our work entirely, but how can we close the eye of judgment? So we're open, we're more free and open to the possibilities. And more free and open to the beauty. I think that we have a real preconceived notion of what's beautiful, instead of seeing that every one of these pots is beautiful.
I closed mine up.
I like that.
No, I closed mine up. I mean, it's...
Whatever.
I'm surprised Tony said that she equated it to working with yeast dough. On the contrary, I found it almost... No, I didn't. Yeast dough has warmth, constantly. Warmth and expansion. And far more responsiveness is what I found. I didn't like the coldness of it, constant coldness. It never became warm. I don't agree with Tony.
Necessary to have is you do have a different experience of it.
One of the reasons,
but your experience when we were sitting here doesn't invalidate hers.
Oh,
and
I
hers
agree.
Doesn't invalidate yours.
Indeed, I agree.
That we can hold both of those in this room.
I think one of the reasons I probably made that association because I was trying to teach. I was teaching a young woman who was a potter to make bread, and the thing that impressed me was she knew exactly how to knead the dough.
Yeah, from her
experience.
Well, you do a lot of that.
Yeah. I like the concept, it's really new to me, of putting your whole self into what you're creating. I'm gonna try to apply this to other things that I go out and create, you know. The relaxation, the feel, it's just all new to me. I'm very pragmatic.
Yeah, you know, Kathy, the feeling I got, it may have been the stream in the background, but it was like you're sitting by the side of a stream with mud, and you're like very primitive working.
Then it gets squished through your toes.
Yeah. I think that there's the tactile sense of working with your hands in that way.
Yeah.
And for me, not every medium does that. When I work with wood, I love working with wood. I don't work with woodworking with my eyes closed. But I don't have the same feeling even when I'm working, you know, with fine wood as I do with clay. There is something sort of primal. And you know, this is probably the first art in the world, in the world, that it was pots that were very functional. We're going back to talking about art. Were very functional, but they became also aesthetic. So what tended to happen was clay, and you can find clay everywhere in the world. You can find clay naturally in every state in the United States, which is a fun thing to do. If you go home, you can find where you can find clay, and you can just make things out of it and let it dry.
Whole yard.
But what essentially is believed to happen is that, you know, things were made out of clay as vessels to hold things, and initially they think it, potentially they could have been doing baskets first, and then they put clay inside of it to help it hold water. The basket got close to the fire. The basket burned away, it hardened the clay, and that was your first firing. That was the first way that something was fired. Yeah.
Long time ago. Yes. Liz said that she didn't know what her pot would be like until she got it first. Mine looked exactly like I thought it would look like. I don't know how mine used to what it looked like when it came off my eyes. It was
what a sense of connection with that.
I don't know. Oh, I knew it.
I learned something about myself. I guess it wasn't anything new in reality. It's so typical of me. I didn't wait for you to give instructions before I started working.
Well, Tony did the same thing.
I mean, that tells me this is something I need to work on is to learn to wait.
Wonderful that you're
I think you expect great things from this.
I had trouble with the last minute where you said just sit and hold it because I wanted to keep
it there. Yeah, me too.
I had to consciously do what you said instead of I visualized. I had a lot of work to do left. Mm-hmm. I had to sit and hold it and think about it.
Yeah, you've been working on it ever since. She had your drive.
And it was a bit arbitrary for me to decide when you were done, but it is something to think about in the creative process is to know when something's done.
Yeah. When to stop.
When to stop. Yeah. When it's done, it's done. And to know when that is.
You don't know if it's
ever done. We need a break. It's
never done.
Should we take 5 minutes?
Yeah. I had this one.
That's a good idea.
Right. We have to pick a date.
I'm always curious.
Usually this goes on the bottom.
It's worth hearing for 20 years.
I know. Can you reuse these?
Good. If you'd like it to be recycled and you can keep it and mash it and do something else with it, if you'd like to contribute it to someone else doing that, you put it back here. Go for it.
Wow.
Yes.
It's not quite round yet.
If I tried to throw mine, it would go over there.
I would have to deliver it. My hands all wet.
You don't have to put it on a bento.
It may be another reason I delivered mine to
It'll be done Friday morning.
You're going to have it fired.
Yeah, I'm just going to have it fired, but if it isn't ready, then I'll have to just take it back in the room and dry it.
That's beautiful. You must have an expert in that area.
That's really interesting. Well, and I want my doctors to be perfectionists. I don't want them to be
I did
cotton for quite a few years.
My daughter is a cotton.
I never received a grant to write down
this process.
Save your little write-up and we'll compare.
Okay.
Yeah. What I said?
Yeah.
Oh, I just wrote down words. I just wrote down words.
Words. Well, that's all right. You can.
I wrote sentences. I raised my hand and I said, I only need it.
Ask the roof assistants if it'll be fine.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome to take more clay and pizza.
I have to fly an airplane. It's doing a big.
Okay.
When is the firing going to be done, Dorothy wants to know?
Thursday night, or afternoon.
Okay, so we're leaving on this part of the last Friday morning.
It'll be done. It'll be out. By this class, I'm hoping they'll be out of the kiln. Because what we're also going to be doing is each person is going to make a tile, and I'm going to make a table out of it. And so we're going to assemble that on Friday.
and we won't be here. Because we're going on the early morning bus to. We're taking
but you're hot. I can send it to you if you bring it to the right.
Oh, it's not bad. Good. I'll dry it in the room. I'll just dry it.
Well, if you want it, we can send it to you.
No, thanks anyway.
You have to pack it.
I'll take it.
Foams.
Yeah, we got a whole bunch of stuff to
yeah. 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 I'll take it.
Again.
And we didn't finish the chicken story. And then she made another round circle. It was the body. And she put little round circles on. And she explained when I draw her picture, I don't draw this well, and I also put some buttons on her out so that you can but I mean, what it looks like is the scribble having. For allowing me into the process, I knew exactly what was breathing.
Well, you even had decorated yours.
Well, I did that since I opened my eyes, which is maybe cheating a little bit, but I immediately have this need to.
You mean you opened your eyes?
Not
while I was already opening my
eyes. Okay,
and
then
you did the same thing.
With my eyes open and like, yeah, it's a tool.
Because it sounds like this one.
Yeah. Well, this is a great experiment. I love it. I made one other pot that I turned that way when I wore all the skin, all my big hands, trying to get it.
Was this on a potter's wheel?
Yeah. That's the one I got. Dredge up the energy that is that one to make stuff. So do something.
I think you're
like
so
well, okay, working on it to do that. It's amazing how it lifts my
Yeah, I think it is going to be.
No, I don't think so. I think the firing is going to be a.
Oh, for throwaway.
Throwaway, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I feel it there.
No,
I don't
know. Oh,
those are the throwaways that I want to make.
This is
the
one
through the airline. That's right. That's right. That's right. I was picturing a blossom. Well, it looks like a blossom.
Consider about regular.
You're regular.
I'm crunching.
She started getting us to relax. Rotated and pressed it more. We kept pressing for quite a little while.
Christianity, although they were concurrent with Christian. Going back to the Bronze Age, there were religions, it's called the mystery religions. And the whole notion of the religion was really about shifting consciousness, shifting from a focus on material and physical reality to a spiritual, eternal sort of reality. So the religion, they were called the mystery religions for a number of reasons. One of them is because we don't know very much about them. They were secret, and they involved a lot of different rituals. There was not anything much written down about it. There is some information written down about the mystery religions from other people finding out and hearing about it, but not from people who were a part of them, because it was a mystery religion. It was about mystery, and so there's not a lot of information about it. The main ways that we know about it, which I thought were also very appropriate to today, is from the pottery. of that time. So the drawings on the pottery show the steps and stages in many of the rituals that happen. But they go back to the Bronze Age. The main place that people are familiar with, if at all, is Eleusis, which is west of Athens. And there's a site that's still there. And supposedly, well, we might have a chance to get into the story. I don't know how many of you know the story of Demeter and her daughter, Persephone. But the well that Demeter was crying at is actually there at Eleusis, and it's west of Athens. So it does go back to about the Bronze Age. During Homer's time, it was a very patriarchal kind of warrior culture. The mystery religions sort of fade away, and we don't know very much about them. But then they come back, and there's more writing and information about them just before Christ, the coming of Christ. And actually, they were pretty strong and tolerated and accepted until about 300, 390, just after Constantine, with Theodosius. And he didn't like the religion, basically went into Eleusis and completely destroyed all the ritual things there. So there's not a lot that we know about it, but we do know that the whole point of it was to transform from the physical reality into a spiritual reality, which is a lot of what our Eucharist service is about, is to move us from a focus only on the physical into the spiritual. But the religion also, these religions were based on agriculture. And back at that time, in classical Greek time, they would plant seeds in the fall, and they would harvest in the spring. And so in the summer, the seeds were stored in the earth. It was pretty hot. So they would store, and now we store grain and everything in silos and stuff. Well, they would store it down in the earth. So there was this notion that from the underworld came life. So the whole idea of the religions, too, was then that from the darkness, from the depths of the earth, is where life comes. So it's only through being in darkness do we come into light. And I bring this up a lot because I think that it's very informing to us about the creative process. It's only by going into the darkness, by letting go of some of those presupposed ideas and notions and our assumptions, by really letting go and going into the darkness. And it could be a small darkness. I'm not talking about a major darkness of the night, but going into darkness, that then we find the inspiration, that we come into light. So the mystery religions, I think, are very informing to us about the creative process. Again, it's very agriculturally based. Many, many philosophers, theologians, Sue can probably help out on this, you know, will very easily trace Christianity and the myths of Christianity to these religions. There's a definite connection. You know, Christianity didn't just spring out of nowhere. It came from a background and a tradition of stories.
You start quoting Jesus, unless the seed falls into the ground and dies, it cannot multiply.
Right. Right. It's not anything new. It's just a thought of that Christianity took some of these notions and ideas and embellished them. And, yeah.
Yeah, I'm having a question now. Do you mean, you say mystery religion, do you mean lost religions in the sense that the we just have pieces of information, it was an open religion, but we have lost the theme of the religion, or do you mean a mysterious thing like there's an initiation and you have to be initiated into it before you know the secrets?
You have asked a very good question. I hope I meant to make that clear. I mean both. Because it is a religion that's been lost, and we don't know very much about it.
That's a definite maybe, huh?
Pardon?
That's a definite maybe you're giving me.
No, it's a definite both.
No, I said it's both. I don't think I said maybe. It's both of the things that you mentioned, and that we've lost it. We don't know very much about it. Most of what we know about is through the pottery and other people's writing about the religion.
We don't know whether we just lost the information over time, I mean, like an open religion, but it was...
No, but they were... No, we do know that it was a mystery religion.
Okay.
And that it was mysterious and that nobody knew about it. And it was intended not to know about it.
Okay.
That these were rituals and rites that you were initiated into. And the way we know that is the pottery shows the initiation rites. It shows in all the symbology and everything when you decode it, as you would in a language. It really shows that it's it was a mysterious religion, meaning that you were taken into and initiated into the mysteries of the religion. Socrates supposedly was initiated.
Secret.
Yeah, and then you keep it secret, and that's why there's not very much information about it, because it's a secret.
Like, the whole few religions?
Yeah.
Yep. Somebody else, and it's no longer yours.
Right. It's in order to preserve it, and also the specialness of those who know it. Mm-hmm. And we could talk more about the whole initiation.
Okay,
it's actually very fascinating. But thanks for the...
What you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that. The main things that I wanted us to think about, though, is the whole notion of out of darkness comes light, and out of the earth comes growth. Comes change, comes development, comes renewal. And the story of Demeter and Persephone, Demeter is usually considered the goddess of the earth and of abundance and of growth. And her daughter, Persephone, is out playing in the fields. There are a lot of different versions of the story. But she's out playing in the fields, walking through the flowers, having a good time. She's this sort of playful, joyful little critter that doesn't think to have too many worries in the world. And along comes Hades, scoops her up and takes her down to the underworld. Again, there's a few different versions about this, one of which she was actually raped and then taken to the underworld. The other, she's just taken into the underworld. And she's in the underworld, and her mother is, of course, distraught and very upset. And goes all over the place, wandering around, crying, trying to find her daughter, and is very, very upset. And she comes to this well in Eleusis, which is this town that's just west of Athens. And all the villagers gather around, and they're all trying to comfort her and console her, and nothing will console her. She's lost her daughter, and she can't find her daughter. And then this character called Babo, who is this little obscene character. This is how she's described. I'm not sure what she looks like. But comes out and does this dance. Does this... Oh, we're not sure. comes out and does this dance. And she gets Demeter laughing. I mean, Demeter hasn't laughed in days and days because she's lost her daughter. And this is what shifts her grief. And she's actually able then to discover where her daughter is. She and her daughter are reunited. There's a big, long story that goes with this. Again, I'm not going to go into, but one of the reasons I bring it up is her daughter, Persephone, had to spend time in the underworld. And she's actually released from the underworld. The tale is that if she doesn't eat anything in the underworld, she can come out and stay out forever. But Hades actually forces a pomegranate seed into her mouth right before she's coming out. And so that means she has to spend half of her life in the underworld and half of it above. So the whole idea, again, is about the necessity of the darkness, being in the dark half of the time in order to come out into the light. In some ways, the contrast between a flat plate and a round bowl. The two are necessary. The contrast, the paradoxes, the differences in our lives are necessary in order to be full and to be whole. I want to give out, one of the reasons I'm tracing some of this for you is to give you a sense of sort of historically what's the connection between creativity and spirituality, because there is a great connection. And another piece that I came across just the other day that I just thought was very fascinating, I'm going to hand out to you. Does anybody have questions about that, about the mystery religions?
No.
There's a lot that's very mysterious that I might not be able to answer.
You have to go back and read.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. One thing I would recommend, and I think there's a couple of Campbell's books over in the bookstore, but there's some good, and it's not real detailed. It's very understandable, and but clear information about the mystery religions in some of his books.
What's the name of that one?
The name of this one is Transformation of Myth Through Time. There's also a book called Myths to Live By. Or you could stick around next week because I'm teaching a class on myth and ritual. We're going to talk more about those things then. Did everybody get one of these? Not yet? There's some. I need to go back there too. This is actually, does anybody have any idea what this is? Any notion of what this is? Yeah, you got a lot of Greek writing on there. It's actually really fascinating. I gave the history about the mystery religions because this connects with this. This was actually painted or drawn in about 1493. And during the Renaissance, one of the real catalysts in what we think about in terms of the Renaissance was that the people went back and used Greek mythology to understand their world in the 1400s. So it was a kind of going back and picking up on the classical Greek notions of the world and understanding the world. So what this is actually on the one side, let's see, on the side of the left that you're looking at, those are the nine muses. Mm-hmm. On the right is kind of the Ptolemaic sequence of the world. You've got your planets, you've got your moon, you've got Earth, you've got your constellations. This is like a cosmology, an understanding of how the world was organized. And it's a bringing together of the classical and the Renaissance. The classical being from the mystery religions. And that's on the left side. You'll notice, you see that there are eight of them, and then you go up to the top. There's one at the bottom. There's a muse at the bottom, Thalia. And then there's eight on the left side. All of those muses are clothed. They have clothes on. When you get up to the top, they're unclothed. The whole notion there is that art is really the clothing of revelation. So art is the clothing of revelation. When we depict something, it's like the clothing of that which cannot be spoken. But when you get up to the top by Apollo, that's the revelation. That's the light. That's the revelation.
What's the three-headed serpent?
That's a good question. The three-headed serpent is your route to the revelation. And can you, I don't know if you can tell what those three things are. It's actually a lion, you got that part, which is about pride.
There's a deer, pride.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and there's a dog, which is about desire. And there's a wolf, which is about fear. And so you've got pride, desire, and fear. And those are the three things you have to face in order to move through to the revelation. And again, I want to connect this to the creative process. We talked about yesterday, what are some of the things we have to let go of? What do we have to face in order to feel more creative? We have to face our fears, our desire that everybody's going to say, oh, God, that's the most beautiful pot I ever saw. And they're going to want to buy it. So I have to let go of that. I have to let go of that desire that you're going to think I am a good potter or that I am a good woodworker or whatever. So there's fear, and then there's desire, and there's pride. And those are the three things that you need to let go of. You need to face in order to move up. The serpent's tail, actually it's kind of a dragon or some kind of a wild critter, in order to get up to the revelation, to have it revealed to you.
Do you know what the Latin words, I guess they're Latin, across the top, or Greek?
I do.
Lion something?
The text is, the radiance, the bliss of the Apolloan mind moves everything. Mm-hmm. No, moves everywhere the muses. The radiance, the bliss of the Apolloan mind moves everywhere the muses. So I want you to also be able to translate this a little bit. It's Greek and it's pagan, the way it's presented here. But this is very Christian too, and that was what they meant in the Renaissance. They didn't mean you to just stop at looking at this as a Greek piece of mythology. It's also Christian in that at the top you have the three naked muses, the three unclothed muses, which in the Greek notion they are women, they're female. In the Christian notion they're male, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. It's a Trinity. And that's the revelation. One of these muses is actually the one who comes down to earth. So one of them is more of the spirit, and one of them is the connection of the two.
Thalia's very
well. Yep. And Thalia's down there. She's down at the bottom. And when she's down there, she can't hear. And the whole notion is there is if you're stuck with your pride and with your ego and with your desire, you can't hear the revelation. You can't hear the song of God. But if you follow this path, and the musicians in here, it's actually, I wish I knew a little bit more about this, but apparently this is a scale. And they said it's an A minor scale. And those are the words of the tones that are written just to the right and to the left of the serpents.
Oh.
Those are actually the tones written in the classical form and then in the Greek form. So I don't know enough about that to tell you anymore, but that's what I understand is that this is actually a scale. And through that, again, it's hearing the revelation. It's a visual picture, but it's also music. And as we move through the muses and move upward, the revelation is revealed to us. And we move from darkness into light. But the darkness is necessary in order to appreciate the light. Yes?
What is tones?
That's tone. Tone or note. Sound. So in a way, in the 1400s and the Renaissance, they were giving us a map to what's the connection between creativity and spirituality. It's mysterious, clearly. But I think there's a lot of information here that's very relevant to our creative process.